So, well, before I start, I should say that both Antoine and Gavi independently asked me to make this talk pedagogical. So I think I've got the hint there, I hope. And so that's the aim of this talk. I mean, so I'm really going to try and introduce these materials. And I know there's several people in the audience who've worked on them. And I apologize in advance that you're not my main target audience. So some very general comments before I really get into this of why we would be interested in these organic materials. So for me, the main reason is that they show this, a lot of really interesting physics in two dimensions, also some systems in one dimension that I won't talk about. And for the materials I'm going to talk about today, they're half-filled systems, but you can also have quarter-filled and non-stoichiometric organic charge transfer sorts as well. And for these half-filled systems, really the physics is dominated by a Mott transition controlled by changing the bandwidth rather than, for example, in the cuprates where you drive the Mott transition by doping the system. And so these are very, very, very nice systems in lots of ways. They're very clean, they're typically stoichiometric, and you see quantum oscillations very easily, and there's a simple, well-understood Fermi surface in these materials. And they have low energy scales, which is kind of a double-edged sword. So if you want to do applications, that's a bad thing, obviously. But for example, a lot of the experimentalists seem to like these systems in the sense that if you want to put on a big field and really kill superconductivity, for example, that's only a few tens of Tesla. And so that's really not so difficult to access. And so that has some advantages for the experimentalists. And another nice thing, I think, about organic systems is really organic chemists. They know how to do an awful lot of things. And they can make these incredibly subtle changes to the chemistry sometimes. And that can give us interesting ways to tune the physics. So what I'm actually going to talk about today is two classes of materials. So these kappa, BDT, TTF materials that are quite well known, I think, and there's certainly a lot known about these materials. And often I'll just refer to these as ET, which is a standard abbreviation for this nasty long chemical name. And also a class of materials that probably very few people are aware of here, these palladium DMIT materials. And this is the sort of the list of subjects I'm going to try and cover. And the first thing I really want to emphasize on this slide is that these are very similar. And so a lot of the interesting physics that we've seen here seems to occur in these physics as well, in these materials as well, sorry. But there's also some very interesting things. There seems to be quite good evidence now that there's a valence bond solid in one of these materials, and some evidence that there's a charge ordered state at half filling, which is kind of a surprising thing if that's true. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to talk about these BDT or ET materials. And just by way of advertising, a few years ago now, Russ McKenzie and I wrote a review on these, and roughly I'm giving the talk of that review, if you like. So these are layered materials, so you get alternating layers of the organic material and the anion. And what happens is you get, the reason these are called charge transfer sorts, so there is a charge transfer when they make the crystal, and you take one electron out of each pair of ET molecules and give it to the anion. And the anion is a monovalent anion, so what that means is even at the non-interacting level, that electron that moves into the anion layer is then localized there, and that's chemically stable, so that molecule here wants to grab an electron, and at least at the non-interacting level, there's now some holes that are free to move in these organic layers, and they have a much harder time to hop between organic layers, and the tunneling rate here is very small. Okay, so this is looking top down on the crystal structure. And instead of thinking about D or F electrons or something, what we're going to be thinking about here is pi electrons. So this is a DFT orbital for a single molecule, and you can see this symmetry here, and we have the pi electrons, which are really going to dominate the physics. And what you see in this kappa phase, the materials are kind of stacked up in pairs like this, which we call dimers. And if you do the density functional calculation for a dimer, what you see is there's a very strong interaction because those pi electrons really point at each other. And so basically, these dimers are very strongly coupled together, or there's a large hopping integral between them, and it's a weak hopping between, much weaker hopping between molecules that aren't in the same dimer. And so a model that's been studied a great deal for these systems is the Hubbard model based on these dimers. So here I take each site as each dimer I take as a site. And then what so if you can imagine that you're integrating out all the dynamics that are going to happen at high energies within this dimer, and then you're left with hoppings between the dimers, and so you end up with this anisotropic triangular lattice. And because each dimer has given up one electron to the anion, this lattice is then half filled. So we have this model here, and this is a very interesting model theoretically. So it can be strongly frustrated. Of course, if T prime were zero, then this would just be a square lattice. If I start turning on T prime and it goes all the way up to the value of T, then this would be a triangular lattice. And if I carry on making T prime really big and T gets small, then that'll eventually become 1D chains, and they'll kind of be coupled by a zigzag coupling, these 1D chains. So even if there were no experiments, this is quite an interesting Hamiltonian to play with in terms of being able to tune that frustration. And of course, the fact that we have materials that are really represented by that Hamiltonian makes it so much the more interesting.
Okay.
Yes?
The reason why there is no T prime along the other diagonal is the question of distance mainly, or the question of symmetry?
It's a little bit of both. So distance is obviously a very important factor, because these things are far enough away that the overlaps are dying off exponentially, pretty much. But also, if you look carefully at the orbitals, they come out in, so this, the orbitals here are pushing out in this direction, the orbitals here are pushing out in this direction, they're not so far apart. The orbital here is coming out here, the orbital here is coming out here, and so they're really a long way away. So this
exists in principle.
Yeah.
It's just very small.
Yes.
So this thing is a rhombus and not a square.
Yes.
I'm sorry, just to sure. You touched on this already, I apologize. We heard yesterday that when one downfolds a complicated band structure to a simple model, one can get more complicated structure of the interactions.
Yes.
Do we know in this case that one really has a U, or is that just a convenient ansatz?
Certainly, historically, it was a convenient ansatz. There has been some very recent work doing this kind of downfolding. I think by your collaborators. No,
I'm not done.
But it's the exact same method you talked about, right? They downfold it into this model, It's not clear to me that they tried to fold it into other models. I think more or less they started with this model in mind. So I think that's more or less an open question. But this is what has been studied historically, I guess, and this is going to be the basis of what I'm going to talk about today.
I have a much more basic question. So this is one layer of these layers you were showing before?
Exactly.
Okay. So these molecules, they order in one layer, and but they are dimers, right?
So if the layer is here, then the anion layer will be sat here, and then the next organic layer will be sat there.
And what is the anion? Did you say that?
I didn't say what the anions are, so they can be...
Do they roll, or is it just to separate the layers?
Apart from taking the charge and separating the layers, that seems... Certainly in the DFT calculation, the bands corresponding to there are nowhere near the Fermi energy.
Okay.
So I don't think I put in any pictures of these kind of spaghetti-type plots. But really, there are sort of two bands that correspond quite clearly, basically, to the highest occupied molecular orbital, or HOMO, of these two molecules hybridizing together, and those seem to be pretty well separated from everything else. So this is, you know, kind of a nice feature. I mean, I'm glad you asked this question, because this is a nice feature that I think a lot of these other bands are really quite a reasonable distance apart, and I forget the numbers, but yeah.
You mentioned that you can change the bandwidth. I guess it's by pressure, or hydrostatic pressure, or is that some...
By hydrostatic... can I answer that question in like one slide? Yeah, it's on the next slide, literally, so...
You said that they were clean, so how clean are they? I mean, how big are the domains or whatever?
I don't know off the top of my head. You see quantum oscillations very easily in these systems. There's one where they're clean. The residual resistivities, given the small values of the Hopping integrals, are quite small. So that was kind of what I was basing that claim on. I guess particularly the quantum oscillations. So at one point, though, I talked with some of the crystal growers, and I was interested particularly in disorder. And they said, I was asking, can you make some dirtier crystals? Because we wanted to look at the effect of disorder on superconductivity. And they said, well, we've tried to deliberately introduce disorder, and basically what you get is a lump of crystal somewhere and a lump of disorder somewhere else. So there's some kind of phase separation that happens in the crystal growth. So I hope that at least partially answers your question.
So exergist is a halogen or something?
So no, they're typically quite complicated. So triiodide is about the simplest one that people look at, and then they can be really quite big, and even they're often polymeric anions. I'll show the chemical formulae a little bit further on. And there's some way where X can be organic as well.
So presumably the electronegativity of it, or whatever you call it, makes some difference for the bandwidth or something?
I think the electronegativity is such that really you want to, the anion always wants to take that one electron out of the organic layer.
Suppose it doesn't want to take it so much.
I don't know that anyone's made any salts where that isn't just a completely dominant effect.
May I ask the question slightly different way? What difference does it make if you change X? What kind of changes do you get?
Right, that's my next slide.
Simple. So did I get it right? You have the structure, it's two-dimensional and it's one orbital per cell, is that correct?
There's a subtle thing that there are two dimers per unit cell.
Okay.
So this is a slight complication that isn't captured certainly in this mapping, and it has often been ignored by theorists, which is probably a bad thing.
The two ones don't speak to each other, or because they're nearly equivalent?
They're nearly equivalent. So essentially you can think of it, you have certainly in terms of the fermiology, so if you just had, in principle, I don't know.
This is the left-hand one of the three.
This one?
That one? Okay. So the dominant effect you see certainly in the fermiology is that if there were one dimer per unit cell, it would look like this. And so when you put the second one in, you basically get a folding over. And so this folds over like this in this unit cell, and a very small gap opens up here. And this gap is very small compared to the Hopping integral. I don't remember the number.
This is like a charge density wave, you could say.
Yeah. It'd be very similar in terms of the folding. And so the two dimers are not strictly crystallographically equivalent, so presumably there's some small crystal field splitting or something there. So my next slide was designed to answer this question about what happens when you change the chemistry. So this is a phase diagram, and a lot of the rest of the talk will be going around these phases and describing them to you. But the axes here, predominantly, there's temperature and there's pressure, and there are two types of pressure. So there's real hydrostatic pressure, and then there's also something that's referred to as chemical pressure. So this is changing the anion along here. And so these are actually abbreviations of the anion that are pretty common in the literature. They're more chemically complex than that. But the only difference between this anion and this anion is that you have a long thing with one halogen in it, and you take the chlorine out and replace it with bromine, and what you find is you go through a Mott transition under that. And what seems to be a pretty reasonable hypothesis is that's doing the same thing as pressure. And so certainly that seems like really what you're doing is changing the size of the unit cell. For example, out here in the superconducting phase, the size of the unit cell seems to correlate reasonably well with the transition temperature, both under pressure and by changing the anion.
And this has been checked, right?
Yeah.
Taking one compound with a given X and applying pressure can actually map out.
Yes.
Phase diagram.
Exactly. And so this phase diagram is kind of a composite of doing those two things.
You have two axes in some sense at zero temperature. One is an overall scale of the hopping, which you can imagine being set by pressure or chemical pressure.
Yes.
And the other is T prime over T.
Yes.
The implication here is the chemical pressure really keeps T prime over T fixed and simply moves you along. Do we have separate handles on the two things, and B, do we really know what line we're going on?
There's an effort to really get handles on that, I think, going on at the moment, but I can't really tell you all the answers. So if I'd given you this talk 4 years ago or something, I would have probably left, or maybe longer ago than that, I would probably left this act. So basically pressure, as you're saying, is going something like bandwidth on U or something. I mean, in terms of theory, there's an axis that's bandwidth on U and there's an axis that's the frustration. These materials here are certainly more weakly frustrated than this material. Everyone would agree on that. This is probably the least frustrated of the lot, and these are a little more frustrated, seems to be the consensus at the moment. But for simplicity, I've just collapsed them all back onto this line. But that's an ongoing problem. Something else that's really, this is an experiment that really blew me away when I first saw it, is so you have 8 hydrogen atoms on this organic molecule. And what the chemists can do is selectively, by symmetry, they can swap pairs of them out for deuterium. So you can have 2 deuteriums, 4 deuteriums, 6 deuteriums, or 8 deuteriums, or 0 deuteriums. If it's fully hydrogenated, it's a superconductor and metal. If it's fully deuterated, it's a Mott insulator. By partially deuterating, what you can do is step through this Mott transition, and that's a first order transition, and you can see the coexistence. For example, Raman experiments, they can see the two different domains, and some of the Raman frequencies, the phonons change slightly under there. And so that's a really unusual dial to have compared to a lot of other things. So you might imagine there are small changes in the chemical pressure essentially due to that. And we kind of thought about that a while ago, and it wasn't really very conclusive what we did, and we never wrote it up, I guess. But I don't think there's a really clear, good explanation of why that's happening, but experimentally it's very clear that it does.
Do they have scattering? Do they know what the unit cell looks like? I mean, usually the difference between hydrogen and deuterium is bond length.
Yeah.
The orbitals and the overlaps change, right?
Yeah. But then I think, I'm pretty sure there are X-ray crystallography experiments in the deuterated. I don't know them offhand. There certainly haven't been any DFT calculations really looking at that difference in terms of the band structure. And really, we're getting back then to the questions that were asked yesterday about, I mean, this is a nice test in a way, because this is a very subtle effect for the DFT to try and capture. And then if you do that band folding down, can you really see those changes, I think? It's actually a really interesting question.
What's this Nernst mean in there?
It means you see a Nernst effect, a large Nernst signal in the normal state, and I'll talk about those experiments in detail. I mean, I'll talk about all of these phases in detail throughout the rest of the talk.
So if you start on the hydrogenated and do the deterioration more and more, can you still be in the superconducting phase?
Yeah, so it's a first order phase transition, and there's coexistence around it. And so as you partially deuterate, you begin to see, I think, I had this cut the real data in and I took it out, but it's down the bottom, so let me. Okay, so this is the real experimental data. This is no deuterium. This is fully deuterated. These are the partially deuterated. This is counting the number of deuteriums on each end. and they're symmetry related, and it's done uniformly throughout the whole sample, so it probably isn't putting any significant extra disorder. Now this is a complicated thing. There are interesting effects about when you do the cooling rate. There is kind of glossy disorder in these end groups which can flop around. So they're also doing the cooling rate here, which is just adds complications. But basically, the overall picture is you see it superconducting, you see some kind of insulating thing starting to happen, and then it goes superconducting, that gets stronger, and eventually it just becomes.
So what happened to this cusp when it dies down? Is it moving as a function of deuterium?
I think it goes up slightly. Do you mean the superconducting
yes.
transition? Yeah, I think that's going up very gently from memory. Certainly, in general, as you get closer to the Mott transition, the TC goes up. Okay. No, we did that one.
And this thing cannot be followed as a function of what you do to this X layer. I mean, in the X layer, if you change slightly, go from, I don't know what, sodium to potassium or whatever.
Right, so it can be what you can do. So these two anions are really very similar. It's just the chlorine and the bromine that are changed. And so what Martin Dressel's group in particular have done, they do optical conductivity studies, is to change the composition of the anion, and then you can move through the Mott transition like that as well. So you can see that physics again in that way. But I stress that isn't doping the system, that's just changing the size.
Big black solid line when you talk about coexistence, basically. Am I to understand that depending on how quickly I cool and all that, this is actually like some rough boundary because basically, in fact, there is a phase separated region, and depending on how quickly I heat it, I can arrive at the insulator. So if I go to the boundary pressure, I can arrive at the insulator phase sooner or later.
Yeah.
So there is kind of some.
Yeah. So let me switch. So this black line is a first order phase transition which has a coexistence region that's actually been mapped out quite well experimentally. This it's a reasonable way. This is a very schematic picture, so I can't really point on the diagram. But Denis Jerome has real experimental data where you can see how big this is. I don't know, Antoine, if you know the width of it in kilopascals or anything.
I
don't either. Sure.
There certainly have been experiments in Marseille in which transport was studied as a function of pressure, slowly ramping up pressure and slowly decreasing pressure at fixed temperature, and you can very clearly see the two spinodal lines of the metals in the insulator. Now, how that depends on the rate at which you change pressure, and so on. The pressures are very low. One should realize that they are in. There are tens or hundreds of bars, okay? So there are a factor of 10 smaller than our material.
Right, so this is a first order transition, it ends in a critical point up here. These solid lines are second order phase transitions, and the dashed lines are probably crossovers. Okay, so now I want to talk about this critical point at the end. So this has been mapped out by Kanoda's group, and they find very odd results that I don't pretend to understand for the critical exponents here. So they find these values in red, which are quite odd and quite different from what's been seen in vanadium oxide and is predicted from dynamical mean field theory. And there's been at least a couple of theoretical proposals to try and explain this. This first paper argues about there's proximity to a quantum critical point, and that's doing kind of funny things. And then this later PRL argues that really it is Ising if you get close enough to the critical point, and really these experiments essentially aren't deep enough into that critical regime. Very recently, so I think the last issue of Nature Physics of last year, Kanoda's group went back and looked at least at this delta exponent with NMR, looking at the scaling of 1 on T, 1 T, and they get the same value from that experiment. So this is strange. I don't think it's really convincingly, you know, I don't think it's really completely understood in terms of these two papers, and that's more or less what I have to say about it. Okay, so the next phase I wanted to talk about is spin liquid. So this is the anion that I've been abbreviating chlorine up to now. This anion I'm abbreviating CN3, previous slide. So these are both MOT insulators. This one comes down, has an antiferromagnetic transition, and there's a slight canting of those antiferromagnetic moments. That means you can see it very clearly in the bulk susceptibility. And this material is believed to be much more strongly frustrated. And you see no sign of any magnetic transition down to the lowest temperatures studied. So this solid line is a fit to high temperature series expansions for the isotropic triangular lattice, so J prime equals J in the earlier model, and that fit is 250 Kelvin. And so these go down to a few tens of millikelvin, and so this is three orders of magnitude temperatures lower than J. Also, this is the NMR, so you see very clearly in the raw NMR signal the this is the antiferromagnetic transition here. You see this big change because of the two distinct sites. And again, you really see nothing except for a very gentle broadening in this compound. It's believed to be a spin liquid. And this, I think this slight broadening is not well understood. People have worried about that. Yeah, I mean, the difference between the high temperature things here is due to slightly different alignments of the field and the samples, and certainly the paper claims this is well understood. It's not well understood by me, but I think this difference is basically a trivial effect to do with the alignment of the field relative to the crystal, and so that doesn't change. But it's this overall broadening. Yeah, that's something to do with the field relative to the crystal, and I think it may be related to the fact that there are these two distinct sites in the crystal, but I wouldn't take that as a fact. But that's my memory, and I'm not an expert in that. But yeah, the experimentalists certainly claim that they're completely happy with that.
So if I'm a book. How many parameters are there in the fit to the chi of the CN3 material? I mean, there's a J, obviously.
There's a J.
Is there an additive constant?
Yes. They've taken it off the experimental data is the way they've actually done it. They've taken off a constant.
So basically, I should consider the signal as being chi of T minus chi of T equals zero, and I should compare that to the calculation. Is that?
Yeah. I think, other than the way the details of how the series expansions are done, so the Padé approximants and the order they've gone to, my memory is that there's no other free parameters in that calculation.
So the basic point is that a spin liquid would be believed to have a vanishing susceptibility at zero temperature, and the fact that the measured susceptibility is not vanishing is attributed to core, right, and other effects that are not interesting.
Yeah. The NMR. Okay, any questions about this? Right. Okay, so an obvious question about a spin liquid is whether it's gapped or not, and that's been investigated by two groups. The authors, as far as I know, are not related in spite of having the same surname. So these three curves here are for other MOT insulating organics. So this is measuring the heat capacity. and you see there's just the cubic term coming from phonons or spin waves or what have you. And then when we look at this frustrated material, they also see a gamma term, which they attribute to gapless spinons. However, the second group measured thermal conductivity, and when they extrapolate this to zero temperature, they get zero or some slightly negative number. And so this suggests that there aren't spinons. And if you plot this on an Arrhenius type plot, you get this absolutely tiny gap that's half a Kelvin or something, which is, you know, many orders of magnitude smaller than J. So the obvious question is, which experiment is right?
Wait, I'm sorry, you say there's no spinons but a tiny gap. Does that mean that the correct description of the data on the right-hand side is a gamma T term of about the same size as on the left, but which ultimately gets gapped? Or is the correct expression just no gamma T term whatsoever, only beta T cubed plus something? Which one are we talking about?
Yeah, they see. Well, they when they look at the low temperature data, they don't have a gamma T, and they're doing a fit to that, and they just have an Arrhenius term. They take off the cubic term, and then they have some Arrhenius term, and that's what they're fitting to.
The Arrhenius term has a tiny gap of 0.5 Kelvin.
Yeah.
So when I get above that gap, is there spinons or not?
I don't think it's clear from the data. I think. So, yeah.
Because the other axis here is T, right? Or is that T squared? I'm sorry.
So this axis is T squared.
Yeah, so 6 in T squared is 2 or something in T. It's well above the gap.
Yeah.
Right, so, okay.
Okay, it's going down. Right, too many animations. Okay, so there's been various discussion about the validity of both experiments, obviously, because they disagree. So the second set of authors worry a lot about the Schottky anomaly that's been subtracted from this data. And there's been some discussion about, particularly on this blog, and I'll put this link. Well, I guess you can see the site, the talk online, and get this link if you're interested. About whether this is really done right. So
do you remember when M doesn't have to be the figure, but do you remember what the stability is doing, say, around half a Kelvin below? Because you show this beautiful whatever the thing is a much higher temperature than previous.
Yeah.
If I blow up, you can have this stability compound. What happens is just, are there any beginning, you know, kinks or some departures from the standard kind of, you know,
I don't remember well, I'm afraid. I can certainly give you the reference if you're interested in.
But I'm sorry, just to harp on this, if we go back, yeah. Just if I accept that value of gamma,
yeah,
what should I see on the kappa over T picture?
I think what you should see is this having an intercept
right.
Here.
It's the intercept. Is the intercept 0.001 on this scale? Is it 1 on this scale? What should I see?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's clearly a good question. Actually, I mean, if you do the extrapolation, the intercept turns out to be slightly negative. So whatever positive value is, you're not really, but whether it's just zero, basically, on that scale, I don't know.
I think it's that in terms of subtraction of cubic term.
I'm sorry?
It's right. Not the effect of subtracting cubic term in solid and accurate at the low temperature.
Right. So then, if it's a very small number, right, that's interesting. Okay. This isn't susceptibility, but it's T1, which is a similar thing. So this, is related. So this is other effect they see in these, and in these papers, which is some kind of hump. About starting at somewhere around 6 Kelvin, which is seen in the heat capacity, it's seen in the thermal conductivity, and it's seen in the NMR.
Sorry,
so Well, this is on a logarithmic scale. So these two are very similar temperature, but the same temperature range. So 6 Kelvin is somewhere here, and it's this thing. Sorry, maybe I should have made those figures a bit bigger. Right, so this, I mean, there's been a number of proposals from theorists about what this thing could be, but certainly it's not settled, and I can't give you a clear answer to what that is, but I think that's a...
But if I come back to just the basic idea that there might be, let's say, spinons in a range between, let's say, 2 or 3 Kelvin and half a Kelvin.
Yeah.
I normally think of spinons as being more or less like a Fermi liquid.
Mm-hmm.
So that would give me a 1 over T1T, which was a constant, and therefore 1 over T1 should be approximately proportional to T.
Yeah.
And I go to these data and I see 1 over T1 is in fact constant.
Yeah.
Rather than being proportional to T. So does what, do people worry about that? What does it tell me about? Do they want to? Sorry?
They want to worry about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. Sorry. Right. So. Okay. Let's move off this topic onto another topic where hopefully, well, if I can't answer your questions on this, two of the key authors are in the room, so I can defer their questions to other people. So there seems to be some nice agreement between the predictions of DMFT of a bad metal and what's seen experimentally. So there's a number of certainly qualitative and at least semi-quantitative, if not really quantitative, agreement. So just go through qualitatively to start with. You see this non-monotonic temperature dependence of the thermopower, of the resistivity and of the Hall coefficient. You see resistivities that have large values compared to the Motley-Offy-Regel limit, and at high temperatures you see an absence of the Drude peak in the optical conductivity. So this is experimental data for the resistivity, and then these slightly more sparse curves are the DMFT predictions for these parameter values up here, and then this is a comparison of...
I can't quite make out. The bottom one is the 10 k bar?
Yeah, that's 10 kilobar, so that's high pressure and that's low pressure. Sorry, that's low pressure and that's high pressure. And so this is near the Mott transition, and you're applying a hydrostatic pressure, and you're going away into a more weakly correlated system. This is in the chlorine source. Is that right from memory?
Did you just hear that 100 bar made a lot of difference?
Yeah, okay. Right, so this is just
a couple hundred more.
Yeah. So, you know, fractions of a kilobar.
So these data were actually collected by fixing temperature and sweeping pressure.
And this is gas pressure.
Oh.
Okay, and so this is the optical conductivity experimentally in one of these compounds that I briefly mentioned earlier, where you're changing the degree of bromine and chlorine, and I stress that's not doping the system. And again, you go from, this is your high temperature data, where is the temperature scale? And then, so these are the high temperature data, and then we see the Struda peak emerging at low temperatures. And again, there's this nice agreement with what Jaime Marino saw in his DMFT.
This is all on one sample.
Yes.
And so there's actually a residual resistivity that decreases the pressure.
Is there a reason?
Yes, the resistivity at the lowest temperature is pressure dependent.
Yeah. All right, you can go. Sorry.
Maybe I should make one experimental comment on that. As far as I understand, the absolute value of the resistivity on this plot should not be really trusted that seriously. I mean, these samples have complicated shapes. and they don't really know the cross sections well, so they don't really know what to divide on the measure resistance.
But it's the same sample.
Yeah, so it's the same sample. So relative comparison. Yes. Yeah. So yeah. That's a real effect. Relative. Actually, there is more to that than is. Yeah.
Yeah.
But relative comparisons are okay. But the absolute scale, you know, this is very large. Actually, in absolute scale, we worry about that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you can trust the absolute number.
But bear in mind, you see directly from the conductivity that the lower pressure samples don't have a coherent through the peak. So whatever. Yeah. Intuition you have from sort of Fermi liquid coherent quasi particles is unlikely to apply. Yeah. That's why it's allowed to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, but at low T, coherent speed is seen again, right?
Well, but if I just look at the molar, this is all.
Yeah, okay. I'm happy for that. Okay, so are there any more questions about this stuff? Changing topic now. Okay, so something else about this low temperature liquid. So it's pointed out, this low temperature Fermi liquid phase that we see, we've just been discussing, it's pointed out, it's been pointed out several times by experimentalists that the Kadowaki-Woods ratios are very large in these systems. So just to remind you of notation, this A here is the quadratic term, the resistivity, and the gamma is the linear term in the heat capacity. And so, there's a number of older papers. This picked one out as an example that was important for us. And that basically the understanding of this ratio is that we see these large ratios in the heavy fermions because these are strongly correlated in the sense that the self-energy is very strongly frequency dependent, and we see these small Kadowaki-Woods ratios in the transition metals because they're more weakly correlated, and that derivative is smaller. And so, for example, Louis Taillefer's group pointed out that in sodium cobaltate you have this enormous ratio as well, and they wondered if this was telling you that some exotic physics was happening. And so we really got excited about this paper that Nigel Hussey wrote, where he was thinking one. I mean, he makes a number of points that this ratio is a little more subtle than people had really thought about before. And a really nice example, I think, is that this is a molar quantity. This is a volumetric quantity. So there's some factor about the unit cell geometry that's turning up in this ratio. And he showed that for the oxides, a lot of these slightly strange ratios can be fixed up a lot if you think about this as a volumetric quantity as well. And we tried that for the organics, and it didn't help very much. In fact, it made things slightly worse. So there's been various experimentalists have speculated about whether this tells you that something very odd is going on here, and that kind of doesn't fit well with our feeling that the low temperature state is well described. Well, the whole Fermi liquid state is described by DMFT, and so we expect that to be a good Fermi liquid. So we don't expect there to be something exotic going on.
Yeah. Just go back, sure. Just to make sure I understand. So in particular, the worry is the two green points at the very top of the figure there.
Well, I think these are also a worry. These points you should be careful about because these are interlayer resistivities. So that's partly why they're so far off.
I see. So I should really look at the two labeled beta I3 and beta IBR2.
So these beta phase chemically are very similar to the kappa phase. There's still this dimerized kind of thing. Much of what we've been describing is seen there.
Okay, but the point is that's in-plane resistivity, and yeah. The A coefficient is kind of between 1 and 2 orders of magnitude above the line that works for ranges of other correlating materials.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
That's the problem.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Again, I guess another example of this thing shooting off is with strontium ruthenate, where I have both the outer plane and the in layer. Pointing at the wrong point there for strontium ruthenate.
Just offhand, right, the physics that you've stressed is that the organics are quite close to a Mach transition.
Yeah.
And just off the top of my head, everything else on your pink line is sort of in the heavy fermion category and is not close to a Mach transition. If we look at VO2s or V2O3s or other things that are close to Mach transitions, where do they sit on this plot?
I don't know. So actually the student who really did this work spent most of his time trying to find these values in the literature. So he kind of hated me by the end of it, I think. So I can't answer I don't think I can answer very many questions at all about things that aren't on this plot, because it turns out to take, you know, 2 or 3 days to find all this data from the literature if you don't know what's going on already. So if people would like to tell me data for these materials, I would be very interested. Okay, so what we did is we started by looking at this old paper that I mentioned before, and we take their phenomenological local Fermi liquid theory that they studied. And so what we do is write down this form for the imaginary part of the self-energy. So at low energies there's some impurity scattering, and then we have this term here. So this is the density of conduction electrons. This is the density of non-interacting density of states at the Fermi level. All the interesting physics is described by this omega star parameter here, which is going to describe how fast this upturn is. In there. So obviously this is a momentum independent thing, so you can think of it, maybe it's overselling it to say it's, but you can think of it a bit like a poor man's DMFT. And then at high energies we have some cutoff function, and that just suppresses, so it goes up to some maximum and then it's just suppressed by this cutoff function, so the imaginary part of the self-energy goes to zero, and we just impose these conditions on the cutoff function, and we say it's just insist that it's monotonic and we don't specify it anymore. And then it's not so difficult to calculate A from this, and then we use the Kramers-Kronig transform for the self-energy to get gamma, and assuming that the mass is large, we get this expression. And I should just point out this parameter chi is basically an integral that you don't know how to do because it runs over f that we don't specify entirely, but it turns out this has to take a value between 1 and 2. So as everything's going to be on a log-log plot, we're not going to be concerned about values of chi. And so when you calculate the Kadowaki-Woods ratio, what you get... Oh, yes, thank you. I've written the rest of it out right. So when you calculate the Kadowaki-Woods ratio, you get this universal term, and there's this highly non-universal term F, which is just defined like this. So this, remind you, is the density of conduction electrons. This is the density of states at the Fermi level of the non-interacting system. This is the non-interacting Fermi velocity in the direction the conductivity is measured in. And this is this factor that's basically 1. And so...
I'm sorry, can we just go back to make sure I understand? So I see one factor then in your definition of the self-energy.
Yeah.
And that factor then is the one that propagates into this F? Or is there an additional factor involved in constructing the conductivity or the resistivity from N squared over M?
I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head. I don't remember one coming in, but...
Okay, because the part of the point is that there are two T squares, as it were, in the resistivity, just empirically. One is, you know, at zero temperature, you have some non-zero resistivity, which is controlled in these kind of theories by a mean-free path, right?
Yeah.
And then you can look at the first small correction, T squared,
right,
where the T squared term is small compared to the mean-free path. Or you can go to slightly higher temperatures where the T squared term is big compared to the tall knot. And you may a priori get a different T squared. So part of what I'm after here is which one of the two are you talking about in this theory?
Right.
And if N is finding its way through there, you're probably looking at the one where the T squared is small compared to the one over tall.
Well, we take the clean limit. So although I've got this here, we let this go to zero very early in the calculation.
The N's in the self-energy should just drop out of the two, so this N must live from somewhere else, right? Because this is a I'm sorry, I had it wrong. It's a ratio of the imaginary part to the square of the real part. So it's exactly that.
Okay, good.
The thing that does drop out is the low energy scale omega star.
Of course,
Very small transition, which of course drops out.
This ending is exactly that end because it's the square of the real part to the imaginary part, and you forgot about the tall one.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm happy.
Okay. And the point, Antoine, can I?
I'm just lost as to what is N, actually.
N is the density of charge carriers. And the point point I should have stressed that Anton made that this omega it's really important that this omega star drops out. So this A is in proportional to the inverse, square of omega star gamma is proportional to the inverse. When I take the ratio A on gamma squared here, then that drops out. And so this is basically describing the strength of the correlations, if you like, and so that's why it drops out. But then we also have this factor F that's going to vary a lot between materials, and it's really just telling us something not particularly interesting about the band structure. So this suggests a different ratio you could take is this guy, and you need to know what F is, so you need to know something about the band structure. So we just did the simplest thing you could possibly think of. So we divide the materials up into those that are quasi-2D and those that are more 3D, and we just assume a spherical Fermi surface for the 3D materials and a cylindrical Fermi surface for the 2D materials. And then basically we can relate F just depends on N in the end. So all we have to know is the number of conduction electrons from experiment, and we get that. It's slightly more complicated with these when we're measuring the in-plane resistivity, and then we have to have some measurement of the interlayer hopping integral and some measurement of the effective mass, which we try and use to get rid of the renormalization of that interlayer hopping integral. But we go ahead and do that, and I should say supplementary information to this paper has lots and lots of details about exactly what we did for everything. And so then when we plot A against gamma squared on F, we get this very nice straight line. Black is the predicted this value here, and all the data for the transition metals, for the heavy fermions, for the oxides and the organics, all seems to lie on the one line. So what we think this is telling us is that really when you're measuring the Kadowaki-Woods ratio, what you're doing is what that raw number tells you is something about the band structure of the material that you're not particularly interested in. So you can't just look at this ratio and then say that number tells me something about the correlations, which is what people have tended to do. And so really in terms of Kadowaki-Woods ratio, the important difference between the heavy fermions and the transition metals is not the strength of the correlations that are going on there, but this factor F is really very different. And part of the reason that scaling worked is because at least within this set of heavy fermions, F doesn't vary that much, and within the transition metals, F doesn't vary that much. So one material that is a kind of interesting problem for us, I think it's actually a class of materials, is bismuth and semi-metals in general. So if you just take this formalism and naively do this, of course this is an incredibly bad approximation for a semi-metal, then we get really bad values. And so one thing that we're working on right now is to put in a realistic band structure for bismuth and see if we can get the measured Kadowaki-Woods ratio right. Another thing that you could do is from DFT, for example, you could really calculate this thing directly, and so you should be able to predict reasonably easily what the Kadowaki-Woods ratio should be in any new material that you're excited about.
But it does look like that you don't need the DFT. The fit is so good even for heavy fermions which have very, very complicated Fermi surfaces.
Well, it depends what you mean by the fit being so good. I mean, I should stress this is on a log scale, so there are factors of 2 or 4. I think about a factor of 4 is about the worst data point on it.
Can you say just in a nutshell that, because there was you corrected a big apparent difference between the transition metals, the heavy fermions, and then the organics, right? So can you say in a nutshell what is the difference in N that really causes that? I mean, is there a simple statement
I don't have a simple statement, and I would really like one, and I have thought I mean, one of the big differences is worrying about which direction you take the resistivity. Yeah, and I mean, that was the big
thing.
Yes. Then I certainly do not have, that's the only thing I have a simple, unfortunately, the obvious thing is the only thing I have a simple description for. Mm-hmm.
Then, if you can give us a feeling of this F parameter has four ingredients, right?
Yeah.
One is the bandwidth, D0 is the bandwidth, right?
What are D0? D0 is the density of states at the Fermi energy, so bandwidth.
Any number of carriers, the Fermi velocity. And psi actually was something from the safe energy.
Yeah, it's a pure number though, it's one or two, and we take it as one everywhere. So you can forget about this.
Psi is out of the structure stuff, but. Okay, and but so for heavy fermions, for example, how did you pick these numbers? I mean,
because they all have multiple bands with different
V's. That's right, exactly.
Right, so we. Right, so we basically took them by and large from band structure calculations.
But band structure calculation for UPT3, I know it gives you six bands, which have bands which vary by a factor of six.
Yeah.
So what does one actually do?
So we tried to sum over all the bands, is what we did, in the case where there are multiple bands, I think. I think that's what we did in virtually.
So why exactly do you use spherical Fermi surfaces?
Because it's easy.
This is for what? For which system?
We're taking them all to be. I mean, this is a good. We used for all the systems for the transition metals, for the heavy fermions, for the buckyball is on here somewhere. I think that's all the others we took us to.
So we just
say there's one Fermi surface, and so that's all very rough and ready.
So you take all the electrons in the conduction band, as it were. You say they live in one Fermi surface, and you assign a velocity which is obtained in some way by averaging over the velocities.
Yeah, well, we just take this for the homogeneous electron gas, and then this and this just depend on n. So we turn everything into n.
Ah, and also these things.
So both.
So then it's not really the band structures of most of these things.
Yeah, it's really n is what's causing.
How do you count n?
Well, we're summing over the bands.
Yeah, but then if you count all the electrons, the semi-core states.
No, we're just the ones that cross the Fermi surface.
So n is the number of bands across the Fermi surface?
No, it's the number of electrons in those bands.
How do you take the difference between the two strontium ruthenate ones? What is the implant?
Okay, so then we. What we do is you need to know what the hopping integral is. So we assume then we're doing a cylinder with a warping due to a hopping integral in the interlayer direction.
No, forget interlayer. Just in plane, you have a big band and several little bands, right, in the SR2 RU04. And I think her question is just in plane, how do you deal with all those different bands?
Right, so in strontium ruthenate, we just took the gamma band because that's got most of the density of states on it. And so we took parameters from there, and there's Meisterhass, Van Alphen, and things.
The gamma band only has, 1.8 of the 4 electrons that exist in the material. So for n, you take 1.8?
No, we take 4 for n.
You take 4 for n?
Yeah,
we're looking. Zero, you take.
No, so once we have it. Okay. No, so what we're taking. Sorry, I misanswered that last question. So we're taking 4 for n, I think, and then we're trying to estimate the interlayer. Right. So what we use the sorry, I'm confusing myself. What we use the gamma band for is we're taking 4 for n, and then we have to estimate the interlayer hopping integral. So you have an experimental number from that. And then you need an effective mass, and so we take the effective mass of the gamma band there to get that as an quote-unquote unrenormalized number.
So it's very obvious, it's very clear once you write it this way. It's very nice that it brings the interlayer versus in-plane things into line, because there's an obvious, very substantial difference in the B squared factor between the two. You're saying that shows up in the Kadowaki-Woods ratio in this way, so clearly it's going to make things more sensible when you define it. And presumably a lot of the other stuff, I mean, I know that just crudely speaking, the bare band structures of the heavy fermions correspond to relatively large masses and therefore relatively small velocities, even to start with, relative to the transition metals. So if you just fiddle the velocities between those two, it probably brings them reasonably close. Is that part of the simple message?
I think this is why I mentioned DFT. This is why we'd like to do this seriously from DFT, because there are all these questions that you can ask, and you can go through all this data and ask whether we've done it right. And we did, you know, we had choices to make in how we did this, calculated this F parameter. And if you do it from DFT, you just get rid of those choices. And so that's something we want to do.
But let me understand. If I want to do it, say, compare cerium and ytterbium heavy fermions, then in ytterbium I have like 13 F electrons, and in cerium I have one F electron. So you predict that this ratio will be completely different in the two compounds?
The F parameter would be completely different between the two compounds by a factor of 13, because I have one as opposed to 13 F electrons.
Right.
So I don't think that works.
No, there will be one hole.
Then you have to know what holes.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a problem. This is another problem with this band structure. Well, I always said charge carriers. I was careful there.
Yes, he said.
And when you have electrons and holes, if you have a compensated system.
That's why we're interested in bismuth. That's why we want to do it. But we haven't worked that problem out. So I'm not saying this
is a local plot, you know. So the accuracy is a factor of 10.
So this, I mean, this is exactly why I said you should calculate this thing from DFT, which was Sergei's question 10 minutes ago or something. We just did the simplest thing possible, and it seems to work. So, and yeah, this needs more testing. This is I think the beginning of a story, not the end of a story. Right. Okay, I think maybe given that I've taken 40 minutes to get here, I'm going to skip over this story.
Well,
you want to see this story? Okay.
Why not?
I'm happy. Okay. Okay, so this is about disorder. So this goes back to some question that was asked ages ago. Okay, so this is work that I was involved in with Steve Blundell and Arjen Ardavan's group in Oxford. And initially we were interested in putting disorder into samples to try and see a suppression of the superconductivity, because we, you know, wanted to know whether it was S-wave or D-wave superconductivity. And that story turned out to be more complicated than we'd hoped, and we found all this other stuff which is probably actually more interesting in the long run. So what this is, this data up here is for a single sample, and what we did what James Analytis did really is he took this sample, put the contacts on, and then measured this first curve up here, which is kind of purple curve, and that's exactly what people had seen many times before. That's nothing new. Then he took it and irradiated it. I think this sample is irradiated with X-rays. We did both X-rays and proton irradiation. And as he measured it, what he saw is at low temperatures there's nothing weird happening. Basically, you're seeing some kind of Matthiessen's rule. You're putting disorder in. This is going up. But at high temperatures, what you're doing, and this really surprised us, is you're suppressing this peak in the resistivity. And particularly something very odd that happens at about 46 Kelvin, where the resistivity seems to be independent of disorder. That puzzled us. It wasn't what we expected to see. So eventually, you know, we spent some time reading the literature, and we found a number of papers talking about disorder-assisted interlayer tunneling. And there are various kind of microscopic treatments of that. There's a few references here. There's more actually in the paper. And they all end up with some phenomenology, if you look at it, that looks a bit like this. So here, this is rho clean is just this purple curve, basically. So that's the pristine sample. And then you have some term that's just your regular Matthiessen's scattering kind of term. And so this X would be the number of impurities, if you like, or something like that, some measure of the amount we've irradiated the sample. And then another term that will look like this, and this is the disorder-assisted interlayer tunneling term. And you can get slightly different expressions for this depending on how you really do the microscopics, but phenomenologically it looks like this. And then these things are basically two free parameters for us, if you like. And so the first thing is, if you fit to the data using this kind of form, you're in a regime where it turns out that you do get this crossing like this, and there is a temperature where it's independent of temperature. And then a second prediction is that the residual resistivity should be proportional to the conductivity at the maximum. So assuming that maximum doesn't move in temperature, which, well, it moves a little bit, but not very much, those two things should be proportional. And so we can plot this for the protons and for the X-rays, and you see, well, if you want to believe it, then you can see it, but, well, you might worry a bit about this data point that's starting to come away. Yeah. For the most disordered sample.
But this would follow very generally if both of these things were linear in the amount of exposure to whatever it is you're exposing them to, right?
Yeah. That's kind of, we're not really saying anything about them, the microscopics, I guess. I mean, if they come out of these theories, if you have some other theory that gives you this phenomenology, then...
No, but I'm saying all you have to do is say that both delta sigma p and delta rho zero are linear in X-ray flux.
Oh, right, sorry.
You're getting straight lines, so they're going to be proportional.
Sure. Yeah, that's entirely correct.
But I'm a little bit lost. The pure compound, in that case, where does it stand? Where is it located?
This is the copper thiocyanate. So it's got a TC of about 10 Kelvin, if that's a good way to parameterize. So it's...
How close is it to the Lamarck transition?
It's pretty close.
What you see is shit.
Yeah, the bromine compound has a TC of maybe 12 Kelvin, and that's the one that can be driven through the Mott transition by deuteration. And this copper thiocyanate is 10 Kelvin, so it's a little pressure. But it would certainly, this is one of the ones you'd expect. There's nothing strange. Exactly. So
if I use this to fit these data, right?
Yeah.
Then your parameter is basically X. You get out an X sigma probe.
Yeah.
Which cannot be small. So there should be a well-defined prediction that the interlayer conductivity should go way up.
Right.
Is that seen?
Well, this is all interlayer.
Oh, this is all interlayer.
Sorry.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, I see.
Sorry. This is all interlayer.
Yeah, so when people show resistance plots, they're almost always interlayer in these materials. There's a very big anisotropy in the resistivities, and you have to be concerned about contamination from the interlayer direction if you measure it. So unless anyone specifies that it's inlayer, it's probably interlayer. One thing that I think you can note, I don't know if it's very conclusive, is that we see quite different. So this is a plot that these two plots I mentioned before. The slope is quite different from when we irradiate by protons and when we irradiate for X-rays. Now, these X-rays come from a copper source, and there is copper in the anion. So you might expect that the X-rays are being absorbed preferentially in the anion layer, whereas the protons are being absorbed more or less randomly.
So the effect in each case is just to displace an atom. So sometimes when you shoot something like a proton through, it really makes a hole through the sample. It's like
we don't know what's happening in the microscopy.
Just nudge things a little bit.
So okay. Yes. So who knows what they're doing microscopically? The point I was going to make is that these different slopes are consistent with this enhancing. This slope is some ratio basically of sigma prime on rho impurity or product of them perhaps, and this is consistent with this term being larger for the X-rays, which seems qualitatively consistent with the fact. I should say also that basically this physics has been seen in samples as grown as well. So depending on you grow samples, they have different levels of purity, and some of them will have this big peak, some of them will be suppressed, and this seems to be backwards. this kind of crossover type behavior is seen there as well. Also in AMRO oscillations, there's data that seems to be consistent with this kind of phenomenological form. And so, well, I just wanted to mention this paper, which recently appeared on the archive, and this is just the disordered Hubbard model without these interlayer terms. And actually, they're calculating the in-plane resistivity here, which is the outer-plane resistivity. But again, they see at least at the high-temperature regime, these DMFT calculations seem to look at least quite qualitatively like what we're seeing in the experiments, although they don't have this crossing over regime here.
They don't have the crossing and the peak shifts noticeably up.
Yeah. So, but you might think the physics that's being captured here is probably whatever's going on in the materials, that physics is, naive assumption would be that it's there. So I think understanding these is a challenge.
Can you go back? I realize that there's something very elementary on this. Why is it that the out-of-plane resistivity is easier to measure than the in-plane? Usually you think the in-plane is the high conductivity, it should short-circuit everything. Usually people have nightmares trying to measure the out-of-plane resistivity because it gets short-circuited by the in-plane.
Yeah.
But this curve is really the out-of-plane resistivity.
Yeah, I'm completely sure, and I'm also confident that's the thing that's normally measured.
No, actually, it's very difficult to measure Rho C reliably because the in-plane short circuits everything. So getting Rho C in organic is always a nightmare. If you put your leads, basically at random, you're going to get the in-plane.
Well, we can. Yeah, I should check.
May I ask then? So this kind of information is then only available for the out-of-plane resistivity, and there isn't a similar trace for the in-plane resistivity as a function of this radiation.
That I am confident of.
And what would one predict?
Based on here, you would say that you will just change the scattering down there, and that this won't have a very big effect up here. That would be, which I guess is quite different from the prediction of the DMFT. So that's a nice experiment.
But in the same resistivity data you showed several slides away from the old paper, also Bahn, and there was the in-plane resistivity.
Okay.
I think.
Okay, I would have to check. Okay, so there's some indication of a pseudo gap in these materials. So this is the NMR 1 on T1T, and so this basically is a fit to the spin fluctuation model of Millis, Moynihan, and Pines. And you see this seems to describe the data quite well. Well, as I understand it, and there are many experts who correct me if I'm wrong, you'd expect from DMFT is that this would then tail off and be flat once we go through the bad metal transition. And that's not what you see. This maximum does correspond with roughly where the bad metal occurs in the resistivity, and you see this drop off, and then this bit down here is superconductivity.
Wait, I'm sorry, just to be precise. I see. So this 50 Kelvin is where the dashed line here is that separates bad metal from pseudogap and coherent transport with metal being the high temperature phase.
Right, so if I go back to the...
Okay.
I go back to the previous.
Yeah.
It's 50 kelvins here. This is,
okay,
somewhere like where that bad metal's going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not clear at all that you see any visible sign of that pseudo gap of the magnetic coefficients in Rho.
Yeah.
But it's definitely seen in Chi. And actually, if you go to the phase diagram, can you go to the next one?
Sure.
Oops. Yeah. This one. There is something very significant here, which is that you see the first order line. At high temperature is such that by heating you go to the insulator, so that's like in V2O3, and that's for the usual reason that you gain in spin entropy. But actually if you look at a lower temperature, which is basically where your red light is, it bends backward.
Yeah. Right?
And this is a sign that the magnetic correlations are setting in. So that's completely consistent with what's going on in the NMR measurements.
Yep. Okay, so if you go out to very high pressures, you don't see this behavior. So here you're seeing something that looks like a simple Fermi liquid. Here you're seeing that it looks like a, you know, when you measure the resistivity, it looks like a Fermi liquid. But when you measure the NMR, you see a pseudo gap. So I tried to find a phrase that wouldn't offend anyone, because that's an easy topic to offend people on. But you see this nice T squared. You see quantum oscillations very readily here. So they're clearly a well-formed quasi-particles, and yet you see this loss of spectral weight in the NMR. So that's something that I don't understand.
If I forget about superconductivity, there's a loss of spectral weight in the NMR, but it only gets you back to kind of the 300K level of 1 over T1T.
Right.
So does that correspond to a Fermi liquid with very enhanced spin fluctuations or weak spin fluctuations? Or, I mean, is it a gap, or are we just moving a bit away from some magnetic critical behavior, let me put it that way?
I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I guess if you had strong instrumagnetic fluctuations down there, then... But no, well, you want them to be...
Turn off the anti-paramagnetic fluctuations a bit. That's not...
Right, but you should be able to see it in the Karinga ratio is the thing to look at, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
The Karinga ratio looks, at least qualitatively, like this. Mm-hmm. So that would correspond then... The Karinga ratio is coming down towards 1. So yeah, it would correspond to some loss of... I'm not quite sure where 1 is on the plot, actually, on the y-axis from memory, but yeah, the Karinga ratio goes up and down like this. I forget where 1 is. So there isn't very much data out here at high temperatures, so I can draw what I like on my speculative phase diagram. But there's clearly at some point this suppression from the NMR starts coming down, and at some point the superconductivity is going away. And it's certainly not inconsistent with the phase diagram, with the data, to draw them hitting at the same point, but the data doesn't say that either. So there could be something interesting happening over here, and I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of years trying to convince experimentalists that this was an interesting place to go and do measurements, and I won't harp on about that here because there's very few experimentalists. Okay. Right. So the region I called Nernst down here this curve is particularly speculative, I should say, because there's really one data point on this curve or two data points, and I've extrapolated to make a little curve. So these are the two materials. This copper thiocyanate. I've drawn it quite a long way out here. This is the one that we saw that the data that James Analytis that we saw the disorder in was in that material. It's 10 Kelvin. It's quite close to the Mott transition. And this bromine material is very close to the Mott transition. This is the one that you can drive the Mott transition by putting in deuterium. Right, so what you see in this thiocyanate is this curve is the resistivity in zero field, and this is these different curves are different field measurements of the Nernst signal. And basically you see exactly what you'd expect in this type of superconductor, so you see very little in the normal state, and you come in superconducting and you get some signal that's presumably coming from the vortices, and they become presumably becoming less mobile down here. And you see something somewhat similar in the bromine material that's very close to the Mott transition, but then this signal carries on and becomes negative. Note that zero is here on this axis, so it goes down, changes sign, and becomes negative. But certainly it does something interesting well above the superconducting critical temperature. And so that's why I've labeled it Nernst, because I really didn't want to give a microscopic interpretation here. But you're seeing something in that region, and it seems to be certainly the argument made in this paper by Steve Blundell's group is that this is because this one is close to the Mott transition and this one is further away. There are also some other subtle differences between these two materials. They're not there's a slight difference in crystal structure. So there could be other explanations, but that seems perhaps the most likely one is that it's driven by the proximity to the Mott transition. Okay. So, well, I've written D-wave superconductivity in the title, but that's maybe a little unfair. There's been a long debate about this symmetry. So one thing that was disorder was discussed, but it doesn't seem to obey this Avrikosov-Gorkov formula that you'd expect when you put large amounts of disorder in. So this has been somewhat inconclusive. The experimentalists have argued for the last decade or two about what the power laws in thermodynamics or heat capacity tell you. The sort of most recent paper is by Tony Carrington's group in Bristol, who go down to lower temperatures. I mean, one problem I think that's been in this field is that people haven't gone to measure these power laws to really low temperatures, and so certainly what Tony Carrington shows is that at high temperatures, both this S wave and D wave can be fit reasonably well using a procedure where you allow the height of the heat capacity anomaly to be a variable, which is what people have used before. And so he shows that some of the argument has been trying to extrapolate things from data that isn't going to low enough temperatures, and he comes out very clearly in favor of D-wave in both, I forget which is which now, I haven't labeled it. One of these is the bromine material, one of these is the copper thiocyanate. So the two materials we saw before. He's subtracting some term off here. I forget what he's actually plotting, but it's delta C. So I don't remember what he's actually plotting. Okay, another strange thing you see in the superconductivity is the superfluid stiffness. So here I've plotted it as penetration depth, which of course is just related to superfluid stiffness like this. So one thing to remember about this phase diagram is basically this line here is monotonic, and so high TCs indicate being close to the Mott transition. And so this is data mostly from Francis Pratt's group, a few other groups as well. And what they see is a very strange thing, that this straight line here, which they just put through the data, is TC is proportional to lambda to the minus 3. And also what you see is that the superfluid stiffness is large, and this is kind of comparable to BCS type values very close to the Mott transition, and the superfluid stiffness gets small as we go away in this direction, which again suggests that something strange is happening over here. But what's really happening, I can't tell you. And I should point out these lines are the theory that works quite well in the cuprates of Emery and Kivelson for 2D and 3D materials. Although the CD is the one you'd expect to be.
Sorry, where's the Mott transition here?
So the Mott transition, Mott transition is here,
yes.
Which is basically here, if you like, on this axis. So these have kind of, they're within a factor of 2 or 4 of
okay.
what a naive BCS would give
right.
you. And then if you go down here, the superfluid stiffness gets really small.
I thought the superfluid density has to get small as you approach the Mott transition.
That's his point.
Yeah.
I'm getting the opposite to what
yeah.
you're saying.
Yeah, that's what I don't understand.
How do you mention Henry Kivelson? Because they
don't no, they don't say anything about the Mott transition. They just give you a relation between rho s, which comes from somewhere, and Tc, which comes from somewhere.
Yeah.
That's the only.
Oh, I see.
I mean, I don't have an explanation. I'm just pointing out that one of the explanations you might want to think about doesn't work. But yeah, this is
about the homogeneity of the superconductivity. I mean, usually this happens when the system is getting less and less homogeneous.
I don't know. Yeah, they're really actually incredible. These points are changing. What you're doing is using chemical pressure to get down here. And there's really very little data on these materials with low TC. Some of the culture of the field is that there's a lot of chemists working in it, and they want to change the chemistry and get a room temperature superconductor for obvious reasons. But this means when you find a superconductor that superconducts at 1 Kelvin or less than 1 Kelvin, it is tended to be forgotten. And I think there's lots of interesting physics in those materials, at least potentially. Okay, maybe I was now going to talk about a theory we wrote down, but maybe I'll skip through this. Let me just yeah, one prediction is that you might have broken time reversal symmetry in the superconducting state on the triangular lattice. And also if you break that slightly, that could lead to a double superconducting transition. So that's a prediction, but I won't go through the details. People have already asked me about the parameterization. Sorry, I'm skipping through because I'd like to talk about these other class of materials, which I think are interesting, but I guess my time's nearly up, so maybe I'll stop after this. So people have asked about the parameterization. For a long time, this has been based on Huckel. If people aren't familiar with Huckel, that's basically a parameterized type binding method that chemists used and kind of stopped using when DFT became available. And so back in the early 80s, when these things were first discovered, that was really the only practical thing you could do. And so people did parameterizations based on that. And a lot of the theory work based on microscopic models has continued to use those parameters, which we're now, people are going back and looking at DFT again and finding that those parameters really aren't very reliable. And so that's, I think, been a serious problem in the field.
Isn't that big unit cell, so it's not so easy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not criticizing anyone for doing this Huckel in you know, the early 80s. It was clearly the right thing to do then. Unfortunately, it turns out probably not to give you terribly accurate answers, or at least it doesn't agree terribly well with the DFT. So for example, one problem, this material that we saw earlier evidence for it being a spin liquid, Huckel gives T prime on T is very close to 1. So I think they always quote these numbers to many significant figures. So I think 1.06 is a number you'll see frequently in the literature, but maybe 1. So this is an isotropic triangular lattice, and we know the Heisenberg model on the isotropic triangular lattice has 120 degree states. So then you have to, at zero temperature, that's, you know.
Yeah, but that argument can be, you can go around that argument, because actually this is true in the Heisenberg limit, right?
Yes.
Once you have the longer range confidence.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was.
Once you have finite U,
yeah.
These terms are not in the Heisenberg limit, and our calculations for those lattices by Combelin and co-workers.
Yeah, this was the point I was about to make, but I thought you wanted to say something, so I stopped. I mean, what Anton says basically is what I was about to say. So I picked out the ring exchange that Motronich has put in, which is basically a phenomenological form of doing this, putting in the Hubbard U. So it's the next term you should see in the expansion. So maybe that's a solution. But two recent type binding parameterizations of the band structure. This is constrained RPA type calculation that we heard about yesterday. And this is a very similar procedure. I forget the details of that one. But both groups agree, doing slightly different things, that at least to one significant figure, they agree on this ratio T prime on T, and it's quite a bit smaller than you see from the Huckel calculations. So this might be another factor that's influencing this problem. So one thing, the data I showed earlier, fits the series expansion wasn't completely convincing. People have gone then to higher orders, so particularly Weihong Zheng and Yan Leitmer and people in Sydney gone to higher orders there, and they find that as you get to higher orders, that fits even better. And they tried varying the parameters, just fitting to a Heisenberg model. So this point Antoine was raising is entirely appropriate, but fitting to the Heisenberg model, you get the best fit you can get to the susceptibility data is for J prime equals J. So maybe that, the problem is that that's the wrong model. I don't know. Right, so the last thing I wanted to talk about was the Hubbard U. So there's been, me and also Jaime Marino, who sat at the back of the room, have been involved in doing a slightly different method from the one that was discussed yesterday. And this is the thing about the thing, we really do have a natural set of localized orbitals here. These molecular orbitals are pretty close, very weakly interacting with each other in the crystal. And so one thing you can do, calculating the Hubbard U is not difficult if that dimer is not in a crystal. So that's something we've done. We did it both for monomers and dimers in these two papers here. And you just calculate it in terms of energy differences of ground state properties. So that's a nice thing, that DFT is much more accurate for ground state properties. So this is entirely just related to ground states. And what people had done previously, before we did that, is to try and think about a two-site Hubbard model, normally with no V in it, but I'll come back to V in a second. And then you think about the fact that U on the monomer is very large, and you take that limit that U on T is becoming large, and you find that the dimer U, so these all have M's are subscripts for monomers, B's are subscripts for dimers. The dimer U is twice the hopping between the two molecules in that make up the dimer. If that on-site U on the the monomer is at infinity. So from Hockel calculations, there's a huge range of values that people have come up with. And this isn't just when they look at different materials, it's also when different groups look at the same material. So this is something that kind of plagues the field, that people just say they did Hockel, and there are very, very many flavors of Hockel. And we found that if you do different flavors, you can get very different answers for this number. So what we find is that this for the isolated dimer has this quite large value here. And this seems to be really, the dimer seems to be a very well conserved structural motif. And that's essentially because you can think of the interaction between the dimer as being very much like a covalent bond. So instead of being between two atoms, though, this covalent bond is really between the two highest occupied molecular orbitals of the material. And so that's much stronger than the weak van der Waals interactions that are holding the rest of the crystal together. And so that really gets conserved. And so when you take those geometries and do them in the vacuum, you get basically the same number over and over again, and the geometry doesn't change. And that's in both the kappa and beta phases, which are the two most prominent dimerized factors. And another thing we find is that this, at least for the molecules, this V is very large. So this V is really comparable to the U, and it's much bigger than the intermolecular hopping. So this approximation that people used really falls down, and this approximation works. If you put these numbers in, take this approximation, you get pretty much this value back. Now, of course, when you put the dimer back into the crystal, there's a large screening because there's dipoles everywhere, in principle, well, what people have done in other materials, particularly most notably, I guess, the fullerenes, is to calculate this by having a polarizability tensor on each molecule and then solving that problem classically self-consistently. And what Jaime Reno's found out is it turns out to be much more painful, this problem in the organics. That's for a number of reasons, particularly because they're kind of long and thin and they're very close to each other. And so this approximation, just having one polarizability tensor in the center of each molecule, really breaks down. And so Jaime can tell you much more about the status of that, but I think they're making quite interesting progress there. But this clearly important contribution hasn't been calculated yet. So if we do this constrained RPA calculation, they get a value a bit less than an electron volt. And also Jaime has, from the fits I showed earlier, the comparison I showed earlier with the optical conductivity from Martin Dressel's group, gets a much smaller value than this, about half the value. Although I think the first week we had questions about how reliable that kind of procedure really was. But that's kind of the status of knowing these parameters at the moment, and this is, I think, very much an ongoing story that's going to be part of this community in the next few years. So that's a good place for me to stop. I had a whole bunch about DMIT, which I guess I'm happy to tell people about privately or some other time if they want. So thank you for your attention.
Actually, you want to comment on these values of U?
I think this first formula there, that is actually like what you do with constrained LDA, right? When you calculate the U from constrained LDA calculation, that's the analog.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing. So this is just a second derivative, right?
Yes, but, exactly.
Well, it's a discrete thing, but okay, so it's the discrete analog of the second derivative.
But that's the analog. You do in solid state, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do there exactly? You put
so we just
electron in the level in the molecular level, which is supposed to
Right. So for the dimer, we just take a dimer and we make it charge neutral and we calculate the ground state energy and it's
put
that.
Put another electron in.
And then we take one electron out. We relax everything. We don't relax the geometry. Typically, we're sticking at the molecular geometry.
Calculate but
we,
the energy.
You do the self-consistent Kohn-Sham problem again. Calculate the energy. That's the ground state energy.
But then the electron ends up in
wherever it wants to go.
Wherever it wants to, right? Yeah. So it's a full.
But this
not really, so then it's not really the same as in constrained LDA, because constrained LDA you really put it in the d orbitals, right? The like the extra electron, let's say.
But we're kind of, I mean,
derivative.
But remember we're doing this for an isolated dimer, so there's no crystal around it. So it's, if you like, it's really, really constrained. It's another way to think of it, right? Mm-hmm. It can only go on this molecule.
Yeah, no, I understand.
It's clear that this very large value of u, 3 dV, has absolutely nothing to do with the effective value of u.
Sure.
Sorry. There's no way the effective value of u is larger than 1 dV.
Sure.
Put it
down. Yeah,
the bandwidth is pretty well known.
Yeah.
It's about a little less than half an dV, right?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
So yeah, it's something like that, yeah. Yeah, I completely agree.
These cells are close to the mod transition. This tells you basically that u is in the 1 dB range.
Yeah, and the other point that it's telling you, though, is that this must be a large number.
Yeah.
And this one thing that you can speculate about is how sensitive this is to pressure. If all the atoms start moving around, and really it's not just molecular contributions but atomic contributions, you can ask. Certainly I think it's an interesting question to know how much that is varying with pressure as well. And as you point out, this real U must be small, like these numbers. Then you're taking a cancellation of two large numbers to get a small number. So even relatively small variations in here could be important.
Yeah,